Hey guys, it's Robert, and this is just a quick drop from the Mushing Podcast. Most people see the finished photo, the perfect shot, the one that ends up on a cover of a magazine like ours, or maybe it's shared on social media. What they don't see is everything behind it, the cold, the timing, the thousands of missed frames before the one that actually matters. Out on the trail, nothing waits for you. Dog teams move fast, light changes by the second, and if you're not ready, the moment is gone. That's what this episode is all about. Today, we're talking with Keila McClenahan from Sunshine and Photo, a photographer who's built her work around capturing the real story of mushing, not just the highlight. From gear and technique to what it takes to really get the shot, this conversation gives you a look at the sport from a completely different angle. We're going to play the full episode here. Let's go.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to this sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of this sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Keila, how is it going today?
I'm doing super good. Thanks for doing the podcast with me.
Likewise, it is a pleasure. I know you and I have been colleagues for a little while with Mushing Magazine and all things photos. I'm happy to jump in and talk to you about not only photography, but dog mushing, overlanding, your dog Jack, and more. Can you do us a favor and briefly tell us who you are and what you're all about? Then we'll jump into what you do.
So my name is Keila. I operate Sunshine and Photo, which at this point does mostly dog sledding photography in the winter. And then in the summer, I teach on the side and also do vehicle photography.
And how long have you been doing both of these?
Professionally, 4 years, which is generally a very short amount of time to be a photographer.
So let's talk about photography first, mushing second, overlanding third, and then combine them all together. What got you interested in photography in the first place?
So it was actually dog collars.
Okay.
As bizarre as that is, I had a friend reach out and she goes, I really need a like dog sledding team picture to complement this dog collar that has a dog sledding mushing team on it. And this is Katahdin Collars and Company. I don't think they're in business right now. She's taking a break, but she reached out and I was like, I've got the dog. I have got a camera. I could totally get you a dog sledding team picture. And then from there, I was like, man, I don't really feel like the clubs are getting good photography of the participants. I don't really feel like the dog mushing community, the dogs themselves, the whole culture is actually getting represented correctly. Like, I want to show the connection between the musher and the dogs and capture that and show it to the general public to help them understand what the magic is there that they may not be able to see because they're not on the trail. You know, they're not really in the parking lots early in the morning, late at night. And that magic is where it all happens.
Well, I have to tell you, even though this is an audio podcast, guys that are listening, this lady right here takes some of the coolest dog sledding photos in the country. She is awesome. We have featured her in the last couple of issues of Mushing Magazine. And in our upcoming issue, one of her photos is the cover. And it is a very cool dryland bike drawing photo. I'm so happy to use that. I guess the first question then about dog mushing and photography is, I'm sure you hear this a lot as a photographer coming from an amateur, but how in the world do you capture the shot?
So this is actually something I teach.
Okay.
Which is a lot of these cameras that are running right now, they're all mostly mirrorless at this point. They are fully capable of auto settings. So I operate on almost full auto settings. I will be an aperture priority or AV for you Canon Sony people. And that basically lets you control your f-stop. But otherwise than that, the camera is going to be shooting at almost full burst and auto ISO, auto everything else. And that enables you to focus on what you're looking at and that crazy fast team that's coming past you. Because if you're shooting like the IFSS dry land stuff, they're ripping past you at 18 miles an hour, which if you sat right next to the trail, it's just boom, they're gone and you've missed the shot or you've got it.
It could be just that easy for sure. But, you know, a person is only as good as their tools, whatever profession you're in. I tell people all the time, I could probably wire my house or fix my toilet, but if I don't have the tools, I better just call a professional. And that's where you come in, right?
That's true. That's true. Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about your gear. You said you're a Nikon person?
I am. I am actually only Nikon. They're all great cameras. I'm going to start with that. Sony, Canon, Nikon, they're awesome cameras. I am literally only Nikon because my grandpa shot Nikon. So I have got some of his older cameras. And I got into it and said, heck, I'll just add to his collection. But there's any of the brands can do all of the things that I'm doing. But personally, Nikon, I just really, really like the battery life. And I talk about that whenever I teach because I'm operating in generally anything from negative 25 Fahrenheit to about 30 Fahrenheit in the winter time. And that puts a huge strain on the batteries. And I think I've talked about this before where I generally put like a hand warmer, maybe two on the camera duct taped on, which is ridiculous, but it helps the memory cards and it helps the battery work at an optimal temperature for the camera. So you don't see any lag, you don't see any slowness, anything like that. And it helps just kind of keep everything going. That big camera, as heavy as it is, kind of keeps me able to operate in these very Arctic conditions without any issues whatsoever.
One more gear question. I am a little bit of a tech nerd, so I love talking about gear. What are your go-to lenses? Do you have a two or three of them that you always carry with you?
Yes, absolutely. So what I mostly shoot my head-on start shoot shots with will be a 7200. I do have the 2.8, but I generally actually shoot it at about f4. Reason being is because you have a very short window where you could miss the shot at 2.8, and it's kind of overkill. The dog teams are so long, you don't really need to be shooting it at 2.8. So honestly, an f4 7200 will work great for head-on shots for long teams or anything that's four dogs or over. My second go-to lens is my walk around the parking lot lens that I use for those very candid shots that people see generally in black and white. And that's going to be the 85 1.2,
okay.
Which is a very, very bougie lens. It's very much for portrait photography. And every once in a while, I will bring it out on the trail. Reason being is that it is a prime lens. So it does not zoom. So in these very Arctic temperatures, you kind of want to pick one prime and stick with it because you can end up with things freezing up. But that 85 really shines because I can shoot it in the dark because it's 1.2. And the front of that lens has got so much glass on it. It lets so much light in. So any of my night shots are 100% going to be shot on that 1.2 85 lens. And then my third one that I go to is a 35 1.2. And I have two prime lenses in there and one really big long zoom lens. And the reason for that is that my feet are my zoom. I like to walk up to my subjects. You know, a lot of these dogs, they're very friendly. They're used to people being around. So they really like to put on a show when the camera's there.
Yeah, I love that. And of course, being at the right spot at the right time is a big part of this. Mushing question, I guess, before we jump into how you travel around to get to all these spots and all that. First off, you are in Colorado. You said that you live near Keystone. So right there at the base of the Rockies, heading into Denver for folks that are listening, ski resorts all around you. Have you always been in Colorado? Did you move there for a specific reason or what?
I have. So I actually was born in Boulder, and then I proceeded to travel around. I got myself into a boarding school up in New York, which is called Treetops in the summer, and then got an NCS in the wintertime for the actual school portion of it. And I spent a lot of my teenage years up in New York. And then I said, well, I've had enough of New York. Let's try Arizona. So I went to a boarding school out there. After that, I actually moved to Germany for a year and a half, 2 years. And no military life. Like, this is all just very much, I wanted to kind of explore the world. And then tried to move back to New York and said, wow, this is a lot of driving.
Right.
Getting to Colorado from New York is like 4 days for me. So I decided, you know what, let's settle somewhere a little bit more central, which happens to be Colorado, because I can access, you know, New York in 3.5 days. I can get to California in 2 days for shoots. Alaska's, I'm working on that. We'll get there maybe next year. Maybe we'll have a better year for both of us. You know, and everywhere else is a day to 2 days drive.
There you go. Yeah. Alaska is very easy to get to from Denver. I know you and I have talked about that before. Mm-hmm. So when you're traveling around, Keela, you often have a co-pilot with you. It's my understanding his name is Jack. Tell us a little bit about Jack.
Jack. He is very much his own person. Like, generally the first question I get is, hey, are you Keela? Are you Sunshine and Photo? And then, where's Jack? is okay. always the next question that people ask me. Jack has got his own personality. He kind of moves like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. So he's got a very, very sweet, kind personality. And a lot of people glob onto that and they go, oh my gosh, this is just a hell of a dog. But Jack is a almost 8-year-old wolf dog mix. So he's a low content wolf dog. So some states he's not legal in, like Alaska. And he's not able to go on some of those trips, but the rest, he generally will go with me everywhere. And part of the reason I have a larger truck is because he is about 110 pounds and 30 inches at the shoulder. He's a big guy.
Well, there is nothing shy of him being pretty photogenic as well.
Yes, absolutely. Growing up with a photographer, he's learned to stop and pose and do a bunch of things for me every once in a while. And he does get to he's very personable. So he will communicate his needs and wants very clearly. There are days that he says, please don't photograph me. And then there are days where he says, hey mom, I'm up on this rock. Will you take my picture? But we used to call him kind of like Dog Gandhi, because anybody that he meets, they walk away and they feel like they are better for it. They've had some experience that makes them feel better inside. So he's been a very special dog and a very lucky dog to own and have.
Well, hey, that is the epitome of a human dog relationship as well. We do a sister show about dog training called Dog Works Radio, and of course that's what we talk about, is that human relationship that we have. So when you're traveling to these events, whether they are overlanding events or vehicle shoots or dog mushing races and the like, let's talk about your setup. And then I want to talk about each type of those events to go. What are you driving? What's the go-to vehicle?
So I did have a Toyota Tacoma, which only was retired in the sense that it is now a toy.
Okay.
And it goes out to the Moab and desert, more off-roading events where I really need to get back in the backcountry, or I really need to, like, you know, do a level 7 or something that's going to be too hard to get a real truck through. But what I currently am driving is actually a Ford Raptor. I bashed on Ford for years. I did. And then I decided, you know what, if it can keep up with me, I used to be really good at breaking things, and the Tacoma has got its fair share of repairs at this point, but I'm like, you know what, if it can keep up with me, then it's good. So I put that Raptor through its paces. Like, I went and jumped it immediately. I went and ripped it around at the sand dunes. But the Raptor is big enough for Jack in the backseat. When I teach workshops, I can still put Grandma on the front seat, and it's super comfortable off-road, because we'll get photographers out into the backcountry and kind of help them get to some of these more remote locations. And it can keep up off-road. It can still use some of those class 3-4 trails if the width is okay, because it's a very wide truck. And the gas mileage is good. So all around, it just kind of checks all the boxes.
With a truck, of course, you can carry a lot of gear. You can definitely have all of your comforts of camp, if you will, if that is your fancy. So when you're out traveling, you said that, hey, you can get to New York in 3 or 4 days, and of course California in a couple, and all around. Tell us about some of the places you visited. Of course, we're going to link your Instagram that has all sorts of your travels, but where are some of your top spots, whether it for vehicle pictures or sledding events?
Ooh, that's a good question. I have actually been collecting spots for a very, very long time. Probably the top ones have got to be outside Moab. Like Moab's amazing and it's beautiful and it's stunning. And if you've never been to Moab, just driving around or renting a Jeep is the best way to see it. But there are so many spots that are outside of the city limits, outside of those common trails, that people have never seen. They're not popular. I think it's called a sand dunes. They're slightly north of Moab, and it's a huge BLM area for motorbikes, but the sand is like this dark coral red. And I do a lot of photography out there, one, because it's BLM. Secondly, because it's pretty quiet, actually, especially in the winter. We're going to be doing some Mustang stuff out there here pretty soon in April, which is going to be very, very fun. But same thing, like, we can get the trucks back there. We've got water for the horses. We've got hay. All of those things are going to be fully accessible. But the scenery is just stunning. It looks like Sahara almost, depending on what angle you shoot it at, you know.
It is beautiful down there. And what about mushing? Where are you going? Mm-hmm. Where's some of your favorite spots for mushing?
I mean, I just follow the clubs around at this point. So I'm really lucky because the majority of them, especially the lower 48, have some phenomenal locations. But the catch is, like, part of what I teach and what I do as far as photography is I try and line up the shot that's going to get all of the elements together. So you get the mountains, you get the dogs, you get the trail, all of those things line up together, but you may not see that. So that requires a lot of scouting trail, a lot of walking, a lot of hiking. So some of these majestic places don't look that majestic from the parking lot, obviously.
Yeah. And I know that you and I have a mutual friend, Fernando, that lives in Utah. I think that's how we originally connected. I saw some photos of him and I said, my God, I've got to put this in the magazine. Who took these photos? And of course he said you, and sort of the rest is history, but heck of a nice guy. He is a sprint musher. He's raced in some of the biggest races in the world, but you also do a lot of work right there in your backyard in Colorado with the Rocky Mountain Club and so on and so forth. Have you done different classes of races? I know you said dry land, and I know you've done sprint, but have you done much of distance races where you got to go out on a trail, like on a snow machine or something like that, to do your work?
So yes and no. So I actually used to shoot ultra running, which is quite distance races. So when I do shoot distance races, the closest one I've gotten to do is the Triple U this year, which is a brand new race. It's put on outside Colville, Utah, and in that kind of trifecta where Idaho and Wyoming and Utah all sort of get very close to intersecting. Phenomenal race. 100% recommend it. They had a sprint race. They had a distance race. And the distance race this year was 100 miles. So that was one where we definitely were able to borrow a snow machine, go out about 20 miles, do some photography, and get some amazing, amazing pictures from that. Some of the sunrise pictures from that spot were phenomenal. The night shots were phenomenal. But we're hoping to get some more distance races. The lower 48 just don't really have long distance generally. They're mostly sprint.
Yeah, and that is really unfortunate. I've been involved with dog mushing since 1994. And a lot of them have come and gone since then. I've done my share of racing in Colorado back in the day. And of course, Minnesota, Wisconsin, all of that. And so much of that now is going to dry land. We were just up at the Dryland World Championships in Wisconsin in October. And beautiful spot. But hey, you know, it's over in just a couple of minutes for for a dog musher, it's tough to travel thousands of miles to run a race in 10 minutes, you know? So speaking of overlanding and what you've done in the past with both of your vehicles, the Toyota and the Ford, what's your setup like? Are you are you a car camper? Or are you going from hotel to hotel, or what's the deal?
So every once in a while, I will get a hotel, mostly if it's going to be like negative 20 or something ridiculous, or it's just, say, for example, like the UP200 is just, I'm up all night, you know, every once in a while I'll get a hotel because I need a place to crash. I need a place to shower. I've traveled, you know, 3 days to get there. So hotels are great. But probably my favorite and best investment at this point is my rooftop tent.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to sound like a total gear nerd. I have a GoFast, which now they are thousands of dollars. When I got it, it barely breached $3,000, which still sounds ridiculous. I have tracked every night that I have spent in that tent, and I have finally gotten it down to about $26 a night.
Yeah. I was doing the math as you said that, because that's how I justify things with my wife.
Yes,
you said $3,000 at $100 a night at a hotel. Hey, that's only a month of hotel nights.
Yeah.
There you go.
So it's pretty good at this point, and I've used that in all kind of weather. It's great in high wind. It's great in snow. Like, I have a great sleeping bag as well, and then we're going to be adding a heater to the truck, so we can actually have a diesel heater piping in heat to that tent to even make it a little bit more bougie, as it will.
Yeah, and you said that you're a little bit of a gear nerd. I as well definitely like our gear. There's a question coming up at the end of the show about your favorite piece of gear, but I don't want to spoil it for our listeners yet. So back to dog mushing. When you're out there with your camera and you're all set up and you're ready to go, what is sort of the day in the life of a sled dog photographer? Obviously, you say you do a lot of walking around the course and the track and all that. Give us a sun up to sundown. What are you typically doing? How much time are you, you know, laying in the weeds with your camera? That sort of stuff.
Man, it can be a rough day, that's for sure. And I see why a lot of people don't do it like this, because it is so much work and it is very cold and you are burning so many calories. I mean, you are out there, if not more than the mushers, because you've got to get everybody coming through. And this is just my personal policy. There's so many ways to do it, but I really like being out there in the elements, finding a great spot on the trail. So generally from sunup, I'm up at around 5. Most of the races start at 8 or by 8 or at some point around then. Generally, I'll be at one of the musher meetings and try and give a little spiel and be like, hey, I'll be out on the trail. If you have any issues, let me know. I can help you. Or, you know, if your dog's trained, hit me, like, scream first or something. But generally, I'm up at 5. I'll do some parking lot candid shots, which I get some beautiful, beautiful pictures walking around the parking lot when there's not spectators out yet and it's just the mushers and the dogs. And then I will pick a day to shoot the start shoot. It's usually the best weather day is one of those days. Most races are 2 days, sprint races, of course. And I'll go out on the trail and either shoot trail shots, which will be wherever the good view is. Could be 5 miles out, could be 20 miles out, but wherever the good view is. And that requires either hiking or a snowmobile. So whatever time I need to get out there, generally 5 a.m. is a good start. When there's a lot of snow and there's a lot of wind, which is Colorado and Wyoming, I will dig a foxhole, mm-hmm. which is generally when after the mushers have all run by, I've got a little bit of break between teams or classes or whatever, and I'll dig myself a little hole. And that way the dogs almost don't see me, because I don't want the dogs to be looking at the camera. I want them to be in a natural state running down the trail as if I wasn't there. Dogs, of course, like to veer. They like to look at things on the trail and they go, oh, look, what's that? And they do start veering towards things on the trail like humans when they're out there, you know, 6 miles and not expecting them. And then whenever the race finishes is when I'm done. Then rinse and repeat the next day, whether I'm on trail or doing start shoot.
I like it. And like you said, it's usually a full weekend. And then, of course, the longer races or, you know, championships and mm-hmm. the like could be several days. That mm-hmm. championship we were at was almost a week long. So it was a long time up there as a podcaster on all that. Next question is, is related to the amount of shots that you take. We had a friend of ours on the show. His name is Andrew Camaletti. He is a videographer for sled dogs. Mm-hmm. He does, you know, short videos, documentary style. And we had him on and he said, man, I have something like 30 terabytes or some ungodly amount of video just from the championships that he was at with me. What does yours look like? How many, and maybe a lot of people don't understand terabytes or you know, memory cards. Mm-hmm. How many shots are you getting per weekend, do you think?
So that's actually one of the most common questions that I get asked. Generally it's in a classroom setting, of course. So my answer is tailored to that, which is shoot as much as you're comfortable editing.
Okay.
Yep. I'm actually comfortable editing quite a bit. I use an iPad and I cull pictures in about an hour. But that being said, an average day for me is about 5,000 pictures for a sprint race.
Wow.
Now, for the UP or the UUU 100, that was about 1 terabyte and 8,000 pictures. 1 terabyte is roughly, I'm trying to think what the total was. It was about 18,000 pictures total.
Holy cow, that's a lot of photos. Going back to our gear question, you said an iPad that piqued my interest. What are you using for that, for editing?
So I am one of the rare few people, and I say that because when I teach, nobody shows up with an iPad, and we're teaching some really top-tier photographers. This is kind of a new school thing, I think. I used to be a painter. I used to be an artist. I did like clay. I did fiber arts. I did painting, drawing, all that stuff. So the iPad for me is a very natural way of editing. The equivalent would be the iOS version of Lightroom is the, I think they're calling it like Lightroom Lite on the Mac.
Okay.
Where everything I can do in Lightroom, I can do 90% of the stuff on the iPad.
Oh, nice.
The only 10% that I need the Mac for is Topaz. Topaz, in case you guys didn't know, is a denoise program and a little bit of an AI program. So it'll like denoise, fix some faces, kind of stuff like that. I mostly use it for the denoise. And that's just for night shots. So only those night shots are being plugged into the Mac. The rest is completely natural. Everything you can do in an iOS version of Lightroom, which is pretty limiting. There's no Photoshop. There's no nothing.
That is pretty cool. And are you using a finger or are you using a pencil?
I have to use the pencil, which is very natural for the drawing.
Yep.
The brush is also very different. So this is something we go over in the workshops too, is the brush on the iPad is very smooth. It's like, I don't know what Apple did, but they designed it. And I have at the Apple universe, just like an AirDrop. It's much easier for cloud storage and stuff like that. But the pencil is basically, it's got a smoothness to it versus right. If you use the brush in Mac, it's kind of blotchy. Like you end up with these weird little blotches where it's got too much, it's got too little. And no matter what Mac you have, it seems to do that, which is what we've noticed in the workshops. So there is a little bit of difference as far as the tools that are available in Lightroom.
Well, Keela, I can tell you right now, we don't even have the show over yet. I'm ready to sign up for a workshop. I'm going to buy my ticket to come down at your next one, and I'm serious about that. So my next question is a question that, or I guess an issue that we encounter a lot, and I know that you do as well, and that's about photo rights. As you know, everybody today thinks if a photo is on Facebook, I can right-click, save to my computer, and just use it wherever I want. And, of course, as a magazine, we're very cognizant with that, with giving rights and all that, because it is very difficult to use one of your photos, and then you and I have a falling out, and then you call me up 6 months from now and say, Robert, take my photo down when it's already in print all over the world, right?
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that, with photo rights? Because, you know, everybody has good intentions. They want to share the photos that you take and all that. And what lines will you cross and not cross in regard to your photos?
That's an awesome question. So the majority of pictures I'm pretty lenient with because, like, say, for example, like one of the harness companies, like, grabs my photo from somebody who bought it, right? Because they're buying a personal photo license at that point from the website. They have to click a box that says, hey, I know I'm using this and I'm buying this under a personal photo license. That's not commercial, right?
Right.
So then they go and then say, for example, let's just use Nonstop. Nonstop says, wow, that's a great picture. Can we share it on our Instagram? And that person, not me, says, sure. To me, that's fine as long as I'm tagged. I generally will reach out if I see my picture on, like, say, for example, Nonstop. And I'll say, hey, by the way, that's my picture. Is there any way you guys can tag me? 99% of the time, this has happened. The company will.
Okay.
So to me, that's promotion. To me, that's free promotion. So I'm fine with all of those examples that have all happened with different companies, commercial or otherwise. I've also made contracts at those companies where they're like, holy crap, you're the photographer. Hey, can we actually do some more? There have been instances where I have had to do a cease and desist, where I have had to spend an hour with a lawyer and say, hey, there's an issue. I don't agree with this person using this picture for this reason or company, whatever. And generally, once that letter has been issued, they do let it go. Mm-hmm. So I've had everything from extreme to I'm not really a big prosecutor as far as that goes. So most people will, as long as they know that it's yours and you say, hey, I don't appreciate you using this, they will let it go. But I haven't been in the magazine world, just the commercial world and the personal world. So.
And what about just the average Joe, you know, who sees a photo of yours, they like it, they didn't tag you, maybe they cut out the watermark, they did all the things, right? They don't like where the watermark is or whatever. are they doing it innocently or are they doing it for what reason, you think?
So they definitely know. There has happened a couple times in the past, and generally it's somebody I know or somebody I'll be seeing at the club in a year. And I've asked them politely, hey, by the way, those pictures, you know, I put my time and effort into it. I really appreciate if you would buy it. Part of what I do to keep this from happening is that I offer the pictures on a tiered scale. Which is not something a lot of photographers are actually doing. So I want everybody with whatever budget they have to be able to purchase their pictures from the race. I don't want them to have to spend thousands of dollars. You know, if you want to, go for it, you can. So I have everything listed on the website as a tiered option.
Okay.
So you can buy the 1 megapixel version for, I think, $490. Off the top of my head, I need to check. I haven't redone the prices in a while. And then the mid-grade version is the 4K version, which we know can be put on most of your TVs and everything else. And that version is, I think, $9 or $10.
Okay.
And then the full version, the original quality, whatever size it is, which, of course, I'm shooting a Z9, so that's going to be up to 40 megapixels, which could be huge. You could put that on a billboard if you wanted. And that one's going to be running you, I think, $15.
So definitely, for folks that are listening, definitely not cost prohibitive at $10 or $15 per photo. And, of course, they get to choose which photos they want. And, you know, if you take 50 photos of, you know, John and his team, he may just pick one out of that 50 to do that.
Yep.
And then they have the ability to use that wherever they want. The last question I have in regard to photography in terms of sports, and I have just a couple of questions about vehicles, is when you're traveling and taking all the photos, everybody wants the photos tonight as soon as they're back at the hotel, right? How fast is reasonable for a photographer to get their stuff up?
It depends. If you're shooting a wedding, you know, expect 6 months.
Okay.
So the answer really varies. I have noticed that most sports photographers' turnaround time is 2 to 3 weeks generally.
Okay.
For races that I've shot before, or I know the course, or I know what I'm planning to do, it's like 2 days.
Okay.
Which is insane as far as like the turnaround time. It max of a week if I'm really putting in a ton of effort and it's like very data heavy, very editing heavy.
So let's talk briefly about your vehicle photography. You said that you also do other things like Mustangs and everything. do you have a favorite? I mean, Are you a sports photographer? Are you a vehicle photographer? Are you a wild animal photographer? Wildlife, I guess it would be. What would you consider yourself?
So generally when we teach workshops, Dan opens it up and he says, Dan Ballard, he says, if it moves, she shoots it.
Okay.
So my favorites are definitely animals, mostly because they have so much emotion, but second favorite has got to be vehicles.
So, which is harder? Obviously vehicles can be going, you know, 60, 70 miles an hour. A dog team can easily go 10, 15 miles an hour. Is it harder to get a shot of like a vehicle compared to a dog team or a horse or even landscape type shots?
Oh, that's a great question, actually. I'm glad you asked that. I would actually have to say vehicle. Okay. Only for the fact, if you want that perfect shot, like you want it to look like a Ford billboard, you have to get all the elements working together. So you've got to get the dust blowing in the correct way. The sun's got to be shining the correct way. The driver has to be doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing at the perfect amount of time. And those don't happen super often.
Yeah.
Versus like the dogs, generally when I lay in front of the start chute, like I will lay very straight, but I'll be on a turn. You can't tell it's a turn. It's like trying to shoot through an S shape, right? Like the S in the alphabet. Mm-hmm. I'll lay at the bottom of the S. They come out of the top, but there's still a straight line between those, right? They may be turning, but at some point there is a straight line. So that's very predictable. It's very easy. They also move a lot slower. And there's not a lot of elements that you have to get all combined together. You know, you've got to get the two lead dogs in good stride looking together. And then hopefully the fourth dog back isn't doing something derpy, which they seem to every time.
From a musher's perspective, for 100% sure.
Yes.
One final question here, Keela, in regard to your process. Just fascinating stuff. I think people are really going to enjoy this. You know, you often hear video creators say, hey, I've got this shot list to, you know, to get done this weekend at this, at, you know, whatever I'm doing, whether it's mushing or vehicles or landscapes or whatever. How do you arrange that? Do you go into it sort of with a blank slate saying, okay, I'm going to get, like you said, today is the best day I'm going to get start shots? Or are you literally trying to tell some type of story with a shot list? You know, I've got to get this shot and this close up and, you know, this angle, all of that.
So I definitely have both.
Okay.
Most of my best shots are random and unexpected.
Okay.
I think the most sold photograph from this entire year was of those dogs running at night where I forgot to turn off my headlamp. Totally random, but that was the best one out of the entire year. And people who weren't even in the mushing community bought that print. But as far as pictures go for the dog sledding, I do have a shot list. I guarantee to the venues, that's kind of what my whole marketing thing is, I guarantee that I will have candids in parking lot of some version. I guarantee that I will have on-trail shots. And then I'll have start shoot shots. So that guarantees that at least every person has three good pictures of themselves from the event.
And I apologize. Another question just came up there. Are the races retaining you, or are you showing up with hopes of selling your photos to the participants?
So they are agreed upon beforehand. Each, as far as Colorado goes, right, each race has their race organizer. And when they are choosing which race they'll be doing, I generally will reach out and say, hey, is it okay if I'm your photographer again? Some will reach out to me and say, hey, by the way, can you do photography for us? And we'll make an agreeance on that. The other ones are sometimes sponsored. So like the Triple U was a sponsored race that I did where I actually sponsored, but I also was the photographer, basically because they have no clubs. So there's no bylaws against that or anything like that.
Okay, so a little bit of both. I guess a little bit of all three. So you may be doing
it
for
depends.
Kind of freelance, meaning you're there to hopefully get some shots sold to the individuals. Maybe a sponsor deal where you kind of have access to it and you're putting up a little bit of cash to do that or something. And then they're actually having you either as a retainer or you are the official photographer. Is there a race out there anywhere in the world that you're just dying to get to?
It's interesting. I would actually love to do the Quest.
Okay.
The Iditarod is a huge one. I get that. Everyone wants to, the Iditarod has got so much media already, and there's so many amazing shots. So the Quest, and then there's a race in Sweden that I cannot pronounce the name of, and I'm not even going to try, but I would love to do that one, mostly because, like, do you know, you guys have ever seen, like, the big snow-covered trees over dog sledding trails and stuff, where just a single track? Those trees are all over the place up there. And I'm like, I would love to photograph that, because you get those pastel skies, you get dog teams, you get all of the elements again working together. And then the snow covered trees are just like a cherry on top.
Yeah, we have, I'm looking at them right now. We call them Dr. Seuss trees up here.
Yeah.
Man, it is a beautiful sight, especially at those sunsets and those sunrises, just on the back of a dog team, not even on a photography perspective.
Yeah.
So we're going to do our best to coordinate to get you up to Alaska next year, even if I have to, even if I have to do one of those sponsor deals like you just talked about. So Keela, I have a few questions. I have a very sneaky suspicion that you're going to answer these just like we need to. The first one is, I know you do a lot of road trips, so you got to listen to some music. What is your favorite song and artist, and or artist?
Okay, so Jack, right? We all know it's a human name for a dog. He was actually named after a song. It's Hit the Road Jack, but the cover is by Casey Abrams, and he's got a duet. And it's a beautiful song. It's perfectly well done. Love that song. I have it play all the time. And I have built a Pandora list off of that, which is like very soft music, which I actually added to. But yeah, that's probably my favorite.
Hit the Road Jack. I know the song. I cannot think of who. Is it Casey Abrams that did the original?
No, I don't think so. It was.
That's like old school.
It was a woman. It's very old school, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not thinking who that is. I'm going to get it. I'm going to share the Spotify link for sure.
It's good. It's really good.
Next up is the gear. You've talked a lot about the gear here already. Your iPad, your pencil, your software, your lenses, your diesel heater, all of that. One piece of gear you always have with you, doesn't even have to be photography gear, other than your cell phone. Or your camera. It cannot be your camera either.
that's tough.
I know it is.
Going through most of my good gear.
Yes.
I think, and this is probably the most uncommon thing in the world. You're probably never going to hear this again. I've got a dog crate, like one of those impact crates.
Yep.
I have a little toy sized version for toy dogs for my food.
Oh, I like it.
Because I've had mice get in my food. I've had bears get in my food. I've had, because they just pull it out of the back of the truck and then they buy, you know. So this crate has survived bears grabbing the whole crate out of the back of the truck, and they roll it around the ground. They can't get in it because it's locked, and it's like meant to keep things in, right? Well, it can keep things out too. I have a dog named Potato. He lives outside, and he jumps in the back of my truck and he cannot get my food. I've got like dehydrated meals in there and tuna fish and all these yummy, very yummy smelling things that attract animals. And it's safer to have it in the back of the truck where they can get it out. They don't rip my truck apart, right? And they can't get into it. So my food stays safe. But that is one thing that goes everywhere with me, because it's just kind of like a grab and go. I grab the crate. It's got everything I need to survive with for months and throw it in the back of the truck.
Well, you know, some people go to REI and buy a bear box for like $30 or $40. You're spending $1,000 on an impact crate?
Yep, because I want it to last. I have seen bear things not last. And they're also so much smaller. This is like, I don't remember how big it was, but it's like the 30-inch or 35-inch or something. So okay. You can fit quite a bit in there.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a couple more gear questions, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
You have a few more minutes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I know that you and I are both fans of one particular backpack. I saw yours sitting on your Jeep seat one day. I love the Wandered pack.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So it's actually kind of sad. This year I had to upgrade to the whole full backpack version.
Yep.
With the waist belt, because I got a herniated disc in my L5S1 area. So the smaller version, the one you and I both have, the Priek, I don't remember how to pronounce it, but yep. That one, I can't wear that anymore right now. I'm limited to 10 pounds on my shoulders.
Okay.
I can have a lot more on my waist. So I did actually upgrade to the full backpack version. And I went into it and I was like, man, I can fit so many more lenses now. No. it was the same amount. But I can fit more gear in the top, which is very nice. And it is more comfortable to wear. So
hey, they are awesome packs. Mine's been all over the world with me. And definitely, and you can go out at 50 below and it's waterproof and you don't have to worry about it for sure. Next up is your super cool hat that you have. Tell us about your hat.
Oh gosh, which hat?
the Western style kind of handmade looking hat that you have?
Oh yeah, okay. So that one is, I got that actually in Missouri. And I had a friend make that. She literally wood burns specifically what you want. And I told her up front, I said, I want a ton of trees. And she was like, give me a day. And then she texted me and she was like, actually, it's going to be 2 days. These are a lot of trees. And she was very, very sweet. And she did actually do them all. So every year I usually do like a custom type hat. And this was the one for this year. And it blew people away, blew the internet away. So yeah,
it is a sweet one. I'm going to try to link up on Instagram and we can give your friend a little bit of love, I guess, on the tag or whatever.
She can totally use it. She makes amazing stuff. And they're all waterproof too.
Excellent.
Versus like your traditional cowboy hat that's like beaver mix or merino or something else that when it gets wet, they can get a little soppy. This is synthetic, you know, but it's completely waterproof because of that. So kind of cool. The design lasts much longer too.
All right. Next one is at your events, whether it be a mushing event or an off-road event, what is one snack that you have out on the trail? Do you have a go-to? Is it like a cheese stick or beef jerky or something else?
Oh, God. I think half the people that hear this are going to find this so disgusting, and the other half are going to be like, really? Tuna fish.
Okay.
You know those packets from the grocery store that are flat, like they went from the cans to the packets or whatever?
Yep.
Because they don't freeze.
Yep.
So I grew up a backpacker, and you know, the smallest, lightest items that you can have are probably the best, but they don't really freeze. They do get a little slushy in like negative 20. But when you're on the trail or you need a quick protein boost or you need something, those are kind of what I go to. They're always my like safety snack, basically. And if I had to choose, it would probably be those honey waffles from Stinger.
Okay, the really honey good. Waffles or tuna. Nobody, I've been doing this a long time. Nobody has said a packet of tuna. But hey, that's why you have to have an impact crate in the back of your truck.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly what.
All right, here we go. Last of these questions here. You are a traveler, as we've talked about. If you're pulling into a truck stop, what is the go-to snack?
I don't really get a lot of stuff at gas stations. I actually make a lot of my food. I do have dehydrated meals on the side, but gosh, I mean, I do have a weak spot. Sometimes every once in a while, I'll get a Twinkie.
A Twinkie. All right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking,
they're just good. They're solid. They're, you know, can't go wrong.
Speaking of overlanding, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Zombieland with Woody Harrelson. He said that the Twinkies are going to survive the zombie attack. So I think you're pretty good there.
There you go.
All right.
Yeah.
Keela, how can folks find you, watch your, look at your amazing photos? And of course, like we said, we're going to put you on the cover of our next issue. So we're going to share you all over the place like we usually do. Where are you most active?
So you will find my professional work on Sunshine and Photo on Instagram. My Facebook is pretty much just personal for the most part. I do have my work post both places, but search the Instagram. You'll find everything on there, and you'll also find a link to the website. So if you want to buy any prints of anything, I do have a whole artwork album of landscapes and other neat things that you may want to put on your walls. That's going to be all on there. So Instagram's your place to go.
Keela, thank you very much for joining us here on the podcast. It is a pleasure. I always think it's going to be difficult to talk to visual people on the podcast, how we're going to tell that story. But man, you got stories for sure.
Thank you so much. You asked some awesome questions. But yeah, I would love to do more stuff with you guys as far as like the overland and any more photography stuff, because it's awesome. I don't like to gatekeep. I like to explain some of the methods that are new and creative to people that they may work for.
All right, guys. Follow this lady on all over the place, for sure. We'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack. Expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.